Macro Voices is pleased to bring you this encore presentation of an interview which originally aired in full color video on Real Vision Television at an earlier date. Real Vision is a paid subscription video on demand channel for finance. In partnership with Real Vision Television, we are pleased to offer Macro Voices subscribers a free trial subscription to Real Vision. To sign up, go to realvisiontv.com/discount/macrovoices. Meanwhile, please enjoy this encore presentation of Real Vision content.
I'm Nathan Egger from Macro Voices. For this week's Real Vision Encore presentation, we're bringing you an interview from late February of 2015 featuring Albert Edwards. Mr. Edwards got started with the Bank of England as an economist, then moved to the buy side working for various firms before settling in his current position at Société Générale. He's been out in 2016 with extremely bearish calls, suggesting that if he is right, the S&P could decline by as much as 75% to 550. I hope you guys all enjoy this week's Real Vision Television Encore presentation.
So Albert, good to finally meet you. We've not met before, but thanks for coming in to see us.
And thanks for inviting me.
Not at all. So give people, some people know about you and other people won't. I think you're quite notorious, but give us a bit of your background and where you came from and a bit of your career and stuff.
Well, I've been working in the industry for about 30 years now. After university, I joined the Bank of England for 3 years, as an economist, very good training ground, before I actually went on to the buy side, the Bank of America Investment Management. And that was quite significant for me, because I used to be, when I was working in the macro side at a buy side house, I used to receive all the piles of research, and before email, days. So these envelopes would be slit open and you have this huge pile next to you which you felt in some way obliged to try and read. And what I learned from that is fund managers haven't got time to read stuff which is 4, 5, 6, and you used to get these books. I remember Gavin Davis, who was at Goldman Sachs, it's great now, you can receive his stuff free on the FT blogs. It's fantastic. But he was at Goldman Sachs and before that Simon & Coates, and every month they used to do this massive book on the UK economy. I used to put in my briefcase, carry it around for a month and feel really guilty at the end of that month that I'd take it out and it'd be unread. So that's one of the reasons why I only write 3 pages. It's not because I'm extremely lazy, as some people say. It's because I think that will probably get read. It's short and concise. So after I was at Bank of America Investment Management, I joined Klein Waltz, which became Dresdner Klein Waltz. I was there for 20 years, doing exactly the same job as I'm doing now, global strategist. Background is economics, but switched to doing global strategy, very top-down stuff. And then I joined Societe Generale in 2007, doing exactly the same job.
So, I mean, I think one of the things that I get tarnished with this brush, and it irritates me, one of the reasons I wanted to get you to come and talk to you for a while, is this brush of being about the perma-bear and that whole thing. I don't think people understand your framework or how you think, because, as you say, people, A, don't take time to read anything anymore, don't take time to understand anything. So I'd love to go through a bit of your framework, but we'll go through that a bit later. Yep. So what... During your career, what were the big calls you had? Because you were quite involved in Asia and other bits and pieces.
I think the Asian call was the biggest and the most difficult one. So in 1996, it had become very apparent to me that the Asian miracle was in fact a macro bubble. My views were partly formed about after going through the UK experience in the late 80s, where early 90s, where Nigel Lawson used to say the huge UK current account deficit didn't matter because it was all investment expenditure and the public sector was in surplus. And then the whole thing blew up and Sterling was in crisis. So you get these regular cycles where the markets anoint some sort of idea, and whether it's the tech bubble or whether it was the Asian bubble at that time, anoint some sort of idea with great credibility and pour money into it. So the Asian crisis was most difficult. And in 1996, while I was writing that all this stuff would at some stage soon collapse, what I learned at that stage was when you write this stuff and it doesn't happen within the next 6 months, people then totally ignore you. Whatever you say becomes totally irrelevant. But and writing about emerging markets in particular at that time. Oh, and by the way, one of the reasons why it was so difficult, because the average UK pension fund in 1996 had about 85% in equities of their total fund. And of their total fund, 10% was in Asia ex-Japan. So there was this huge institutional bet that emerging markets were the way forward. And I've got a book from the... It's amazing how these consensuses build up. I've got a book from the World Bank, which I keep just to remind myself of how these consensus arrived. And it's titled something like, it was published in 96, Thailand, Sustainable Growth and Long-Term Development. Everyone really believed in the story. But the problem writing about emerging markets as opposed to developed markets is people can get a bit twitchy and a bit more stroppy than if you write about developed markets. So when I described the Malaysian economic policies in 96 as Noddynomics, Noddy for our American listeners who may not know, is a children's, Enid Blyton children's character who goes around in a little car in Toyland. With a hat with a bell on the end. And the reason why I got the idea of Noddynomics, and it's I'm quite pleased, if you Google it, it is a word I've actually managed to invent. When I was writing about Asia, a client, who I think is still around, wrote back to me by fax in 96, because I didn't have an email, by fax, wrote to the head of research, basically trying to stop me writing this stuff. And said, your knowledge of the region compares unfavorably with Noddy and Big Ears. Big Ears was Noddy's friend. Noddy and Big Ears' knowledge of subatomic physics. And I thought, well, this is brilliantly written. Great idea. So I coined the phrase Noddynomics to mean a very naive form of Char-like economics, which would go horribly wrong. And the South China Post, bless them, after I put this note out at Kleinwort's, basically, our Asian desk went absolutely mad. So the report was pulled the next day. It was pulped, but unfortunately, everyone heaved, and I hid under my desk so the senior management couldn't find me for a while, because often it can be quite career-ending, these things which happen. Hid under my desk for a while, and everyone heaved a sigh of relief. But what they'd forgotten about in those days, so nothing got posted out, but they forgot in those days, things got walked around the city. So at mid-afternoon, up popped on Reuters, Kleinwort slams Malaysian Noddynomics story. And the South China Post, bless them, picked up on this, had a picture of Prime Minister Mahathir with all his economic Indians, with Noddynomics question mark above his head. And writing up the fact that it had been pulped, etc. And Kleinwort's lost all its banking licenses as a result of that in 1996. Wow. Having said that, that saved them a year of lending into Malaysia before it collapsed. But I didn't get any thanks for that. So that was my most difficult call. It was the Asian crisis. I use that in good stead of how these firmly held consensus is built up.
When you say difficult, it's difficult because the consensus was so strong, everyone hated you for saying the opposite.
Yeah, exactly.
So then what happened when you got into the early 2000s, so 2000, 2001? You clearly must have been slightly concerned about the world then as well.
Well, yes, the tech bubble was another obvious one. And, you know, I used to have some very difficult meetings, you know, going around with clients. I say to them, yes, a lot of these companies are growth companies. They will do very well in the future. But a lot of them are also deep cyclical technology companies who've had an extended period of growth. But when the cycle turns and there is on a 100 times forward PE and profits go down 80%, they've got the wrong profits forecast and the wrong rating. They're rated as a growth stock. And I said, well, most of it will blow up. And it's another good example of very easy money going into 2000 being misallocated into projects, you know, the telecoms in particular, digging up the roads and laying cables everywhere where there's no profitability in it. A bit like canals or railroads or something like that. A bit like shale oil, very loose money goes into these projects, over investment. So that was quite a difficult. But the secret I found when you're doing it, because these views are quite unusual on the sell side, because most bears in anything, when they're wrong, get flushed out the system, they disappear. You can get it wrong for a while. The skill and the secret I found was being able to hang on to your job by not annoying the client so much that they ask the head of research to boot you out. And that's been, I think, the greatest skill I've acquired over the years. Because you get some, and I used to tell my colleagues, you know, the client is always right. Your job is not to go into the fund manager and actually demonstrate that you're a genius and everything they think is totally crap and wrong. It is to engage in a conversation with them and form a partnership. But certainly I used to have colleagues who used to go in who had the same views as me, and they would piss off the client so much that they would not survive.
So I guess the idea is going into somebody saying, listen, I know your view differs, yeah, but this is my thoughts. And yeah, maybe you can build some of that into your framework, and that adds value. Anybody who can't listen to an opposite viewpoint is an idiot.
Yeah, well, but you've got to do it with a bit of humility, because if you're, I think with my experience on the sell side, if you do it too aggressively, you don't want people to switch off during the presentation. You don't want them to start flicking through their presentation and not listening to what you're saying. So it is. When you've got a very unpopular message, and being a sort of bear on equities as I still am, it is generally an unpopular message, because the whole industry, both buy and sell side, does better profitably when the markets are going up. So if you're saying, well, this is all going to go horribly wrong, we're all, you know, the equities are going to go down 70-80% or whatever, you know, you've got to be able to engage and with the clients. I mean, I'm lucky. I've been very lucky. I have to say, both the places I've worked, Kleinwort, which became Dresdner Kleinwort, and at SocGen, the management have allowed me to write what I've wanted to. People have said, had I worked in an American bank, I would never have been allowed to sort of have such extreme views. They're extreme in an investment bank. Plenty of independents have got my very similar views. So I've been very, very lucky in that respect. I've had quite benevolent employers.
And so how did you get on in the period going up into 2007-2008?
Well, I think the pinnacle was when Maestro book came out about Alan Greenspan, and at that time, same time, I was writing that he was a prospective economic war criminal for what he was doing. I don't know how that got past the editors, but and it was very difficult marketing in the US, because you could just see this was going to go horribly, horribly wrong, and the longer the cycle was elongated. I mean, and there were two schools of thought essentially with the Great Moderation. And it was the same with tech, it was the same with the Asian crisis, all of them. The longer it goes on, people throw in the towel, and whether they throw in the towel and go all in as they did during the NASDAQ bubble, where people really believed in the story. They weren't cynical investors. They really believed in it. Or say now, where our clients have to participate in what's going on. They can't just get out of equity, or most of them, especially long only, can't just get out and stay on the sidelines. They'd be out of a job within 3 months. If you like, they're forced to participate in the madness which is going on. But it was very clear from about 2003, 2004 onwards, this was a deliberately created bubble to stop the two. And I've got a quote from Fed Governor McTeer in about 2003. We need to create a housing bubble because we've got the corporate sector in 2001, 2002 retrenching and correcting its massive borrowing deficit. We don't want the household sector to do it also at this time because it will result in a deep recession. So let's create a bubble to keep things going. But it's really, when I look at the mess we're in now, and I think it really is a mess. I mean, it really is a continued pumping up of things going all the way back almost to LTCM.
Do you think the bubble is now in central banking? Is that where the bubble is?
The bubble of belief is in central banking. Yes, that is just like the bubble of belief we saw in investing in Asia in 1995-96. And we've just had a conference recently. We have a big January conference each year, and our guest speaker was Mark Faber this year. And I hadn't seen his speech before and his slides, but both of us independently came to the view one of the biggest risks out there was a collapse in confidence from investors. The central banks could actually control events. A bit like happened in Japan in the 90s. In the 80s, there was incredible confidence that the Ministry of Finance and the Bank of Japan was totally in control of the economy. And eventually, that confidence dialed all the way back to zero on the roll.
So what happens if we lose confidence in central banks? Because I think that's coming as well. I think at some point, I think, from my view, probably Japan is going to be the first to lead the example of how all of this, all the QE and everything else, is all kind of fake puff, that it doesn't actually do anything. And Japan may lose control of its currency. Don't know. Somewhere, somebody's going to lose control and we're going to realize that the central banking thing doesn't work.
Well, I mean, we haven't rehearsed this. And I didn't know your views exactly beforehand, but actually I would agree Japan will be first into that crisis of confidence. I do think they'll lose control of events. I think I'm not a monetarist. I'm not a Keynesian.
Me neither.
What I see out there is a lot of polarization of views about what should be done, how it should be done. And you've got the Krugmans on the one hand, and you've got...
I was just speaking at Warwick University this weekend about this problem that there is only Keynesianism and monetarism, and what they've now done is blend the two together and do everything all at once. Of which none of it works.
I'm quite eclectic in my ideas. I'm not sure what works in this situation, the mess we're in. And it's a bit like the old joke, you know, you ask someone the way somewhere and the answer is I wouldn't start from here. But I think Japan, because seeing what they're doing, which in terms of monetary intervention, you see these charts in the FT, and I've copied them into my presentation, you know, central bank balance sheet as a percent of GDP. And what the ECB is doing hardly registers, and what the Fed has done is hardly registered, because on the top of the scale is Japan going off to 80% of GDP, whereas the US and the Eurozone are down at about 15, 20 max. It is absolutely off the scale. I would agree with our friend John Malden that Japan is a bug looking for a windshield. And I think, there is this view with central bankers that their confidence or overconfidence is touching. There is, and as my friend Dylan, my ex-colleague Dylan Gry says, it's quite amazing given how much they screwed up in 2007 and given essentially the same people are around. You know, Janet Yellen sat around the table in the run-up to 2007. You have to look very hard to find any quote where she dissented from the general view, because she didn't. It was a consensus view. But what I find touching is the view, and it was expressed by Mervyn King at the Bank of England, which is, look, all these people who said QE would cause inflation are absolutely wrong. Because it hasn't caused inflation yet, because it hasn't caused inflation, we're going to plow on and carry on doing, if need be, exactly the same thing. So all these people, and I think there was a big letter to the Fed, open letter from economists in the US, and I think Bloomberg was taking the piss out of them. All these people should apologise because, you know, they said it would produce inflation and it hasn't. I'm not a monetarist, but if you print enough money, if you give everyone a cheque for 1 million, 2 million, 10 million, and print the money, it will create inflation. There is a trigger point where you can create inflation. I don't know where that is. The central banks don't know where that is.
And the question is when you're creating that inflation, it's not generally a benign inflation. It is currency collapse and everything else that goes with it, because the value of the notes has fallen. It's not the kind of inflation that we know, demand driven. It's a total collapse in money.
Yes, and I think part of the problem is, again, overconfidence with policymakers, that they understand, even after 2007, where it was clearly apparent they didn't understand how the system worked. Is there absolute confidence, and it's not just for the public consumption. Bernanke, when he famously said I disagree with your premise, there will not be a national house price recession in the US. It wasn't just for public consumption. He really believed it. In one-to-one meetings, he was saying the same thing. He really believed it. And had there not been a national house price recession in the US, a lot of the AAA rated CDOs, which are piled high all over the place in investment, they would have not blown up. He was 100% confident CBS that he would be able to control inflation.
And that makes it seem as hubristic as the tech boom was back in 1999, 2000, when nobody believed anything could ever go wrong.
And I think once again, that is part of the problem. It's the good times rolled for a number of years. People's memories are very short. I mean, I was in a client meeting the other day, and the senior person, the CIO, said, Albert, not only do you have to go into more detail about, because I was saying, well, what's happening in Asia now is a mini repeat of the Asian crisis. We may well talk about that.
Yeah.
They say, well, Albert, not only do you have to tell the audience here more about the Asian crisis, because none of them have ever been through it. None of these people have ever been through the tech crisis. You know, they're all so young.
Wow.
And, you know, maybe for people like me who don't earn enough money to exit the industry early, we've been around for 30 years, and these things rhyme and chime again and again, and they're all slightly different. So for me, the Eurozone crisis, I've explained it to people, the Eurozone crisis was a classic balance of payments crisis, very similar to what happened to Malaysia and to what happened to Spain and Ireland and Portugal. Wasn't that much different to what happened to Malaysia and Thailand and South Korea in the mid-90s. Classic balance. And if we put these in these contexts, when you've seen a few of them, and I've got a very poor memory, but I can actually remember these significant events, it all seems very similar. And you just think, it's like the current equity environment, where you just think, you really just know how it's all going to end up, and it's all rather sad. And all you can do is just warn people. You can't do the timing, because, you know, these things go on a lot longer than people think inevitably. But you know it's all going to end badly, and the economy will implode in on itself, and people will look around for someone else to blame. We blame the bankers, we blame the politicians. Who should we blame this time?
But, I mean, that's another worrying thing, is who do you blame the next time? Okay, we've got the central bankers to blame. They've not been done yet. that bonfire of the vanities hasn't happened.
Yep.
Then after that, I worry about the political side. And we've seen it in Greece. We've seen it. I think we're going to see it in Spain. I think Podemos will come into power. Yep. And I think we're going to throw out pretty much all of the existing kind of two-party systems that exist in most places by the end of it, because people want something different. Because we seem to, these crises seem to be getting bigger in magnitude and reasonably frequent now.
Yeah. I mean, and it really is a revulsion with the ruling orders, who all seem, whichever party wins the election, to pursue the same policy, essentially the same policies of the previous party. And I suppose the Tea Party was a bit of a manifestation of this as well, a revulsion about, you know, the ruling elite. But one of the reasons, to go into more detail, well, I've said all the way along that I think the Eurozone will break up. And explaining it to our US clients, it's unlike the US. Europe has a habit of very small extreme parties coming up in popularity very, very quickly indeed. And if not taking power, shaping power. So, and you don't have to, I'm not talking about Germany of the 1930s or anything, but, you know, even countries like, you know, it's Denmark, Holland have it, have extreme far right. In the UK, we've got, even though the economy is doing better, UKIP, for example, people looking for someone to blame. And certainly this was something my former colleague Dylan Grice used to write about a lot, is how the population eventually looks around and blames minorities for their problems. That, you know, if you look back in history, this is very, very normal's not the right word, but we've seen it many times.
And that's before. Why I know it always sounds extreme, and I've certainly written about it, and a lot of people I respect have written about it, that the logical conclusion to a lot of this kind of systemic issues ends up being warfare.
Yes, it is. I mean, it's Marx who said all wars are economically related, but it's
now whether that's true warfare or whether it's a political revolution or whatever. I mean, I don't know what format, but
well, I think Pepe Grillo of Five Star Movement in Italy, talking about warfare, it's was quoted as saying, I got this right, I got this from Miss Shellock, who dug it out. He said, we're not at war with Russia or ISIL. We're at war with the ECB scum. Now, they're not that far from taking power in Italy. And if my scenarios, and I believe the Eurozone, I believe the global economy will go back into another recession, global recession. The policymakers cannot eliminate the business cycle. The business cycle is always there. They might delay it, they might extend it. The more they extend it using debt, the deeper the subsequent recession. They often make the eventual downturn far worse than otherwise would be. My own view is I think we certainly in the next 6 to 18 months could go down into another global recession. I think it comes through currency volatility.
My view is identical. I think either this year or next year is recession global, and or the higher probability, nothing's a certainty, and that currencies lead it.
I think when I see clients, I say to them, look, you think the Eurozone has got a deflation problem. China has just got just as bigger issues in terms of deflation.
And debt.
And Japan as well. And the regime change, and I think Japan, again, could lead the way. And I've said to investors, you know, a lot of Western investors, even if they're investing in European-only equities, just totally ignore North Japan, especially because Japan went off and did its own thing in the 90s. Japan was something you didn't really need to look at. And we've always looked at, we were very lucky at Kleinwort in the 90s, our Japanese strategist, a man called Peter Tasker, still writes in the FT column. He's at Arcus now, a partner at Arcus. It's a small fund management house out there. But he came and spoke at one of our January conferences a little while back about Japan. But you can really get often an early warning of what is going on by watching Japan. And the new regime in Japan, it is a total sea change. That they are, for rightly or wrongly, determined to create 2% inflation. Actually, a lot of Japan's deflationary problem is down to demographics. GDP per head in Japan for the last 10 years or so has been much better, if not as good as the US, better than the US per head. And there are a lot of supply side problems. So the previous governor used to just shrug his shoulders and you say, well, it's not my problem. I can't deal with this problem through monetary policy. And I have sympathy with that. But the new lot, Abe and the new government, absolutely determined that we can create 2% inflation with by printing money. And I'm sure eventually they can. It's a very tight labour market. Part of the flip side to having very poor demographics is if you look at the Tancan survey, the labour market is already very tight. It is having a major benefit, not on the economy particularly, but where you can see it is corporate profits. So I was looking at a chart of S&P corporate profits over the last 18 months are basically flat and have now started turning down because of the strong dollar. And I think they're up about 5% over the last 18 months. Topics, 12-month forward earnings is up 45%. If you look at whole economy profits, so the US has a whole economy profits measure, so does Japan. These include a lot of small, unquoted companies who in Japan, remember, are supposed to be being hurt by the weak yen through higher raw material costs, oil costs, etc. Well, whole economy profits are basically flat again in the US, and they're up about 35% in Japan. So even if you include all these small, unquoted companies which dominate the quoted companies, net-net, it seems to be good for Japan. The secret is to get that into a wage price spiral. And I think they'll do it. I think they will do it, and I think they'll lose control of it. Because I think the bond yield will start to rise. They can't afford for the bond yield to rise. And I think this is where I agree with Kyle Bass's view in terms of being a big JGB bear in the medium term.
Although his view is really mainly the currency first.
I would agree with that. I think the authorities go to tremendous length to hold down that bond yield, notwithstanding that it has more than doubled over the last month or so. It got down below 0.2% the 10-year, and I think we're now up at 0.45. And people are saying, is this it? Is the Japanese bond yield finally blowing up? I think the fiscal arithmetic, I think Japan is bust with half, you know, they will never, it's a bit like Italy, they will never be create enough growth to pay that, sum back, whatever the interest rate is. They can extend and pretend, but actually the capital sum cannot be paid back, a bit like Greece, a bit like Italy, et cetera. If interest rates double or triple, if people believe the JG, the policies are being successful and Japan really is moving to 2% inflation, then the JGB will start trying to head to 3%. Now, they're bust at 0.5% interest rates. They're quadruply bust at 1% or 2%. So the authorities will hold it down for as long as possible. And what I think they're trying to do is essentially take all the JGBs off the financial sector, because eventually they know when this yield gaps up to 3%, 4%, it will bankrupt, it will destroy whoever's holding them. And it's better that the Bank of Japan holds them and just monetizes it away than having a big sector pension fund holding them.
So this is the argument that a lot of people have, is they can just monetize the debt. The modern monetary theory guys all say, well, just monetize the debt, be fine. But my argument with that has always been, well, if you do that, then your currency is worthless.
Yeah, well, you will see the volatility in the currency, essentially. The currency starts heading down very rapidly indeed. As undoubtedly, I think actual inflation will come back. I mean, I can remember in the UK, 28% inflation. And actually, ironically, Japan in 1972 had 28% inflation as well. It was the US. When I go around the US and Europe, I say, well, you didn't really have inflation in the 70s or 80s. It was only about 12 to 15% in most countries. That isn't inflation. For a developed economy such as the UK or Japan to have 28% inflation. And my own view is, it's even though I've been overweight government bonds in our model portfolio since the end of 1996, I've, for a long time, overweight government bonds, underweight equities, strategically.
And how's that bet done? Because this is, again, one of the things that people go, oh, perma-bear. They don't understand that, you know, it's not like you're short equities. There's whole ways that you think about things and places that you find interest to invest in. And that bond bet's been a pretty decent bet.
It has been a decent bet. And global, the global government bond index, 10-year plus, with coupon reinvested, has actually, since I made the call, which is the back end of 1996, which was about 3 years too early, because you had that ramp up in equities. But even doing it from when the call was made, government bonds have outperformed equities, despite the S&P having tripled since 2009, with a lot less volatilities. And that was the big call, because as I mentioned earlier, the average UK pension fund and insurance company at the back end of the 90s had 80, 90% of their portfolio in equities. And what I was saying is, look, I think the lesson from Japan is this trend we've been in since 1982, where equity yields and bond yields come down together, and it's a bull market for both assets in terms of valuations. That ends, as it did in Japan in 1990. And the equity yield starts to rise. Equities derate. Equity yields start to rise. And bond yields carry on falling. And you get this break. You get another scenario, which I call the ice age. And in that scenario, if you go into that as a pension fund, long equities and short bonds, just forget it. You're insolvent because your liabilities rocket up through the roof, which is actually what's happened to many of them. But I'm still a government bond bull. I'm still positioned like that. But on a even on 3-5 year view, I look at what's going on. I just think, you know what? I wouldn't touch government bonds with a barge pole on a 3-5 year view.
So what else? We'll talk about your view in the ice age, but in a bit, but what else interests you in the world? So if you have to invest in something, is there anything that interests you?
Well, I think it's very, very difficult. I think central bank policies mean most assets are pretty or very or obscenely expensive. Mm. And you can play a relative game and say, well, you know, relative to government bonds, then equities look okay, as many people do. But everything is grotesquely expensive. Even within the equity markets, the median, whether it's median P, median price cash flow, whether it's EV EBITDA, we're back to the levels of extreme expense that you saw in 2007 and 2001. And where it's similar to 2007 and not similar to 2001, is the dispersion of valuations is very, very low. So everything is expensive within the equity market. In 2001, there was just one key sector or sectors which were expensive, but you could find lots of cheap stocks. The median PE of the market was hugely different to the median, which was a lot lower. So you could find lots of cheap industrial stocks, etc., but you can't find really very much at all. And I work with guys, and whether it's Andrew Lapthorne, who works for me on the equity quant side, or Dylan Grice before, and James Montier, they tend to come at it from a bottom-up basis and do stock screenings for deep value. And actually, one of the few places we can find pockets of value is actually in Japan. So not only has it got I think, interesting macro backdrop, as long as you can hedge the currency. And Dylan wrote a piece quite a while back if Japan does lose control and ends up, say, like Israel did in the 1980s. Because people say, well, actually, you can only have rapid inflation if you're an emerging economy like Brazil or Argentina or Zimbabwe. Israel lost control of inflation in the 80s. The reason, as is often the reason, is fiscal insolvency. They just had too high expenditure, mainly on the military. They printed money to pay for it. They totally lost control of inflation. And Dylan was saying, well, actually, if you replicate Japan's experience onto Israel's, then you're looking at about 20 million on the Nikkei. Clearly, the currency would be God knows where by then. You want to hedge it, but you can hedge. You know, the curves are flat. You can pin your foot. You can buy a 5-year, 40,000 out of the money call, pin it to change your currency back into whatever you wanted to, at a 5-year level or a 10-year level. And I think that's a pretty good sort of insurance policy where you just put a little bit of money in it. Forget about it.
But in so that opens a whole load of questions. There's something I'm thinking about in my head. For example, if we think that there's a global currency war going on and everybody's trying to devalue currencies, yep. Okay, the US dollar standing out as a strong currency, but does that mean that all the equity markets go up because the denominator's changed? Because I like to look at things in a relative value. And yep. If you think of it, if your denominator's falling in value, then the price of the asset goes up.
That is an interesting one, which I've not really got my head around.
No, because it would mean that even though we're bearish,
yep.
per se, on what's going on, and the outcome is a central banking outcome of currency, yep. then maybe the equity market goes up tenfold. I mean, we've seen it in Iran, we've seen it in Venezuela, we've seen it in Argentina, we've seen it almost everywhere, except countries that ended up with huge economic catastrophes, they tended not to.
Yeah.
But the ones who generated inflation and kind of lost control of some stuff saw the stock markets just counterbalance the fall in the currency.
I think the stock markets, yeah, in nominal terms do. I mean, the stock markets will tend to, in that environment, track the nominal earnings, which are rising very, very rapidly indeed. The only problem, I say, is the currency, if it falls relative to the other currencies. And it's a question of who's first into this. And what is the impact? Suppose it is Japan. What is the impact where one of the biggest bond markets in the world, if it's suddenly, Japan suddenly does have 2 or 3% bond yields and has very rapid inflation? And, you know, that is like throwing, I mean, I haven't really thought it through because I think it would just totally throw a hand grenade into the global financial.
So I'm just thinking, first going back a little bit, so in equities, let's say you get the currency collapse and because they're holding down bond yields.
Yep.
So the equity market takes off yep. for the reasons we talked about. So it goes up and doubles and triples and quadruples or whatever. Yep. But then they lose control of the bond market.
Yep.
Then the equity market goes as well, doesn't it?
I think, yes. I think you'd see quite a sharp retracement. But it's so, I mean,
isn't it?
I'm saving thinking that one through because I think it's sort of maybe a sort of 3 to 5 year. I think we go through another, deflationary bust globally before that. But I think we're teeing ourselves up for something much, much bigger because in another deflationary bust, or bigger deflationary bust, I think the US moves back to QE. There's no alternative for these people other than to do more of what they have been doing. In the US, I think at its height was doing $85 billion a month. You know, maybe they'll do $185 billion a month ultimately. No. But they will just keep on going with this because they're under immense pressure to solve things, to be seen to be doing something. And I think QE2, QE3 was a massive mistake. I think it was a total waste of time, massive mistake in distorting the financial markets. I think in a deleveraging world in the US, you are going to get weak growth. What do you expect? And I think doing quantitative easing didn't make it that much better for the economy and has left all sorts of problems in the financial sector to blow themselves up at some point in the future. But I think there is such pressure. There was such pressure in 2010, 11, 12 with the sluggish economy to intervene to make things better that ultimately you end up making things 10 times worse, but you only see that.
So here's a weird thing, is the amount of people I've interviewed through this Real Vision Television, or I know myself, who are not kind of publicly, don't have to have a public bias, you know. So a lot of strategists, as you rightly know, can't say a lot of things. Almost everybody says, this quantitative easing thing is a fucking disaster waiting to happen. And yet, for some reason, it still perpetuates. Almost everybody privately, any sensible hedge fund manager, any sensible pension fund manager, anybody on the analysis side just says, this is absolutely a disaster. And yet it continues.
Yes, I think you did have some, I mean, certainly in the Fed, you had Fed Governor Stern starting to get very concerned about how frothy the corporate bond market was
getting. Let's assume that amongst us, there's two or three smart people. Maybe we're all idiots, but there are amongst us.
Got to be some somewhere.
Somebody's got to be smart, and they're all saying the same thing. And surely the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England and everybody else can't just be going, la, 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 I'm not listening.
Well, I think one of the problems, or part of the problem, has been appointing academics to the head of these central banks. Bernanke and Mervyn King at the UK was a former academic. I don't know what Mark Carney's with, he was an academic. But academics seem to have great certainty of view, that their view of the world, their models are correct, and everyone else is an idiot. Krugman's a very good example of someone who verbalizes that quite outright. And as you say, there are dissenting voices. I mean, prior to the First World War, Dylan had a very good slide, which was about how money printing wasn't going to cause inflation because we understand how the system works much better than we previously done. And this was before the First World War, just before inflation went absolutely rampant. It's that overconfidence and intellectual arrogance that you don't meet many people in this business with a huge amount of humility, I have to say. And it's that certainty of view which is so, so very dangerous. And what is more shocking, I find, is after these people screw it up so badly, and to me, the primary responsibility for the 2008 Great Recession was the central banks. It wasn't the commercial bankers, it wasn't the people in government, it wasn't the politicians. Everyone played their bit part, including the consumers leveraging up. Everyone played a role. But, you know, when the old adage is, you know, when the party gets going, it's time to take away the punch bowl. And what Alan Greenspan did was quite clear. Now, people wanted to go home. It was midnight. He bolted the doors and he was forcing people's heads into the punch bowl, you know. And that became the mantra of the central banks. And Bernanke did the same. And the solution to the debt problem is more debt. Now, I don't go to the extreme which says, the view which is so that fiscal deficit shouldn't go up. Of course in Spain, if you have the biggest, and the UK, What happened in Spain? What happened in the Eurozone was to a large extent not of their own making. You know, if you're locked into this currency regime, you're given the wrong monetary policy, you are going to explode out of control and become uncompetitive, etc. Huge. The UK and the US chose these lunatic policies.
See, everybody. What I love is how people talk about Greece as their fault, Cyprus their fault. They're all idiots, and the Spanish were idiots, and they forget, or the Japanese are idiots, and now it's becoming the Chinese are idiots. But the fact is everybody borrowed too much money. Yeah. Everyone got confused that money, that debt is money, when debt is in fact the inverse of money.
Yeah.
And that's what they forget. Everyone's done the same thing.
They have, and I have to say, I've been quite hard on the central bankers, not because I don't think they're doing their best.
No.
But I just... There hasn't been any comeback. People, you know, in the UK, Mervyn King was actually given a knighthood by the Conservative government just as he was leaving. He was the guy responsible for presiding over one of the biggest housing and credit bubbles in history in the UK. And it's all very well to sort of wash their hands of it and say, well, it's either the US and the USA. And Bernanke got his economic departments to go through it all and say, well, in retrospect, we couldn't have done anything different, because it was all surplus savings coming over from China, which was washing over us and pushing our bond yields down, etc., etc. And it was it's all just bullshit, you know, just trying to push the blame onto someone else. You know, there were huge surpluses in China coming over to the US, because the US was running one of the biggest trade deficits, current account deficits they'd ever run, on the back of incredibly loose money, rampant money supply growth, rampant consumption and a housing bubble, which so that these huge surpluses coming in, washing in, were a mirror image of the current account deficits in the US and the UK, very, very similar. And I'm sure if interest rates had been considerably higher, they could have knocked it on the head. They just didn't want to. When the party's going on, people, you know, no one likes a party pooper.
So do you subscribe, I do, a reasonable amount, that we should just leave the business cycle be a bit and not overly manage the business cycle and let... Because Singapore does a reasonably good job, and Hong Kong, they've built some imbalances now, but generally, by allowing the business cycle, it kind of clears this stuff up. You don't get these massive imbalances. What do you think?
I think there is... I say I'm not an Austrian. I'm not a monetarist.
But I
do think there is some merit in that. I mean, quite clearly, when you have a massive rise in the savings ratio, as you had in when the private sector credit bubble went bust in the US and the UK and Spain, the savings rates of the household sector rocketed upwards. The savings rates or the financial deficit of the private sector in these countries went into huge surplus. I mean, now the mirror image of that was always going to be that the government budget deficits would rocket upwards. And I remember writing in 2007, before this all collapsed, said, when not only will we go into deep recession because these excesses, these credit excesses, are just so big. And I used the model I tended to use was one Rob Parenta also uses, you probably come across. Wynne Godley at Cambridge used it, was sectoral imbalances. If you look at the sectors, the household sector borrowing requirements, the corporate sector borrowing, it reached extremes of deficits. And they carry on borrowing on the back of rising asset prices or imaginary profitable gains in the future of TMT. And then something comes along to prick that reality, and that huge deficit, usually about 4 or 5% of GDP, snaps back into a surplus. And so you are going to have the budget deficit rocketing up. So I remember writing in 2007, when the US and UK, budget deficits for the government were 3% of GDP, that we'd end up with a double-digit deficit. It would be inevitable. And actually, the one criticism, one of the key criticisms I had of governments, is actually at that stage of the business cycle, they should have been we should have been starting off with a surplus. Maybe not a big surplus, but a budget surplus of about 1 or 2% of GDP. So when the inevitable deterioration of 8% of GDP came, you didn't end up with an overall budget deficit of 12%. You ended up with something more like 8, which would be more manageable for the market. So, but you see this going time and time. As I said, I think what's happening now is very obviously, there are different nuances, there's different soundtrack might be playing in the background, but essentially it's you're at the same party, they've just changed the soundtrack.